lesbian client. I could not reveal this information because to do so would be to put my own client at risk of a conviction leading to the death penalty. Attorney-client privilege survives after death. However, there are exceptions to the rule of privilege. If revealing protected communication will help right a continuing wrong or prevent serious injury or death to an innocent person. And that is exactly what I'm trying to do now. Charles Gaston, an investigator in my employ, took the facts as revealed to me by Ulmer and investigated the matter. He determined that a young woman named Danielle Schuyler was sexually assaulted and murdered in her home in Toluca Lake on October 22, 1987, and that Preston Borders was later convicted of the crime and sentenced to death after a trial in Los Angeles Superior Court. I subsequently went to San Quentin to interview Borders, and he retained me as his attorney. In that capacity, I sincerely request that the murder of Daniel Schuyler be reviewed by the Conviction Integrity Unit and that the District Attorney's Office right this wrong. Preston Borders is factually innocent and has spent more than half his life in prison under the threat of state-sanctioned death. This miscarriage of justice must be remedied. This request is the first of many options available to Mr. Borders. I intend to explore all avenues of amelioration, but I am starting with you. I look forward to your expedited reply. Sincerely yours, Lance Cronin, Esquire. Bosch read the letter a second time, and then quickly scanned a letter of receipt from Kornblum to Cronin that told him his request would be given the utmost priority and urged him not to take any other action until the CIU had the opportunity to review and investigate the matter. It was clear that Kornblum didn't want this case spilling into the media or referred to the Innocence Project, a privately funded legal group that had a national record of overturning wrongful convictions. It would be a political blunder if the work of an outside entity instead of the district attorney's much ballyhooed unit led to a revelation of innocence. Bosch went back to the chrono. The letter from Cronin clearly got the ball rolling. Soto and Tapscott pulled the files and went to property control, where the evidence box was found and opened on camera. While the forensics unit studied the contents for a new or overlooked evidence, the two detectives went to work reviewing and reinvestigating the case, this time with another suspect as a leading person of interest. Bosch knew it was not the right way to work a murder case. Rather than looking for a suspect, they started with the suspect already in hand. It narrowed the possibilities. Here they started with the name Lucas John Ulmer, and they stuck with it. Their efforts to confirm that he had been in Los Angeles at the time of the Schuyler murders were less than conclusive. They found employment records at the billboard company where he worked as an installer that appeared to place him in L.A., but little else in terms of housing records or live witnesses who could attest to his whereabouts. It wasn't nearly enough to take the case further, but then the lab reported finding a minute amount of semen on the victim's clothing. The material had not been stored under today's DNA evidence protocols, but because the piece of clothing had been in a sealed paper bag, it was in remarkably good condition and could be tested against samples from both Ulmer and Borders. Ulmer's DNA was already in the state's offender databank. It had been used at trial to link him to the rapes of 7 different women. But genetic material had never been collected from Borders, because he had been convicted and sentenced to death row a year before DNA was approved for use in California, in courts, and by law enforcement. Tapscott flew up to San Francisco to go to San Quentin and collect a sample from Borders. It was then analyzed by an independent lab, and comparisons were made between the evidence taken from Daniel Schuyler's pajamas and the samples from Ulmer and Borders. After 3 weeks, the lab finally reported that the DNA on the victim's clothing had come from Ulmer and not Borders. Just reading it in the chronological record made Bosch break into a cold sweat. He had been as sure of Borders' guilt as that of any other killer he had taken to trial and put in prison. And now the science said he was wrong. Then he remembered the seahorse. The seahorse put the lie to all of this. Daniel Schuyler's favorite piece of jewelry had been found in the secret place in the apartment where Borders lived. DNA could not explain that away. It might be possible that Borders and Ulmer knew each other and had committed the crime together, but possession of the seahorse made Borders culpable in a big way. At his trial, Borders had testified that he'd bought an exact duplicate of Schuyler's seahorse at the Santa Monica Pier because he wanted one for himself. The jury didn't buy it then, and Soto and Tapscott should not have bought it now. Bosch switched back to the chrono and soon found out why they did. After the DNA matching came back, the investigators, as a pair, returned to San Quentin to interview Borders. The entire transcript of the interview was available in the documents, but the chrono referenced the specific pages where the discussion about the seahorse took place. Tapscott, tell us about the seahorse. Borders, the seahorse was a big fucking mistake. I'm here because of that fucking seahorse. Tapscott, what do you mean by a mistake? Borders, I didn't have the greatest lawyer, okay? And he didn't like my explanation for the seahorse. He said it wouldn't sell to a jury. So we go into court and try to sell a bullshit story that nobody on the jury believed anyway. Tapscott, so the story about you buying a matching seahorse pennant on the Santa Monica Pier because you liked it, that was a lie you told to the jury? Borders, that's right. I lied to the jury. That's my crime. What are you going to do, send me to death row? Tapscott, what was the story your lawyer said he couldn't sell to the jury? Borders, the truth, that the cops planted it when they searched my place. Tapscott, you're saying the key piece of evidence against you was planted? Borders, that's right. The guy's name was Bosch. The detective? He wanted to be judge and jury, so he planted the evidence. Him and his partner were completely bent. Bosch planted it, and the other one went along with it. Soto, wait a second here. You're saying that weeks before you were even on his radar as a suspect, Bosch took the seahorse off the body or from the murder scene and carried it around with him so at just the right moment and with the right suspect, he could plant it as evidence? You expect us to believe that? Borders, the guy was really obsessed with the case. You can check it. I found out later that his mother had been murdered when he was a little kid, you know? There's this whole psychology to it, him being this obsessed avenging angel, but it was too late by then. I was here. Soto, you had appeals, you had lawyers. How come in 30 years you've never once brought up that Bosch planted the seahorse? Borders, I didn't think anybody cared or anybody believed me. The truth is, I still don't. Mr. Cronin convinced me to tell what I know, and that's what I'm doing. Soto, why did your lawyer back at the trial say that claiming the evidence was planted was the wrong move? Borders, remember, this was back in the 80s. Back then, the cops had a free ride. They could do anything and get away with it. And what proof did I have? Bosch was like this hero cop who would solve big cases. I had no chance against that. All I know is that they supposedly found the seahorse and a bunch of jewelry hidden in my house, and I was the only one who knew that I didn't have the seahorse. That's how I knew it was planted against me. Bosch read the short section of the transcript again and then moved on to two amendments that were attached. One was an obituary from the California Bar Journal for Borders' original attorney, David Siegel, who had retired from the practice of law a decade after the Borders trial and passed away soon after. The second amendment was actually a timeline constructed by Soto that showed when it was during the investigation that Bosch wrote the initial report stating that Daniel Schuyler's prize seahorse necklace was missing. The timeline showed all the days that went by and the case developments that occurred during which he would have had to hold on to the seahorse before planting it in the hiding place in Borders' apartment. The report was clearly an attempt by Soto to delineate the tenuousness of the claim that Bosch planted evidence in the case. Bosch appreciated Lucia's efforts on his behalf and believed it might have been the reason she got him a copy of the file on the down low. She wanted him to know that what was happening was not a betrayal on her part, that she was watching out for her former mentor, but letting the chips and the evidence fall where they may. That aside, the allegation that Bosch had planted evidence in the case 30 years ago was now part of the record of the case, and it could blow up publicly at any moment. It was clearly the leverage that Kennedy, the prosecutor, hoped to use to quiet any protests from Bosch about the move to vacate the conviction. If Bosch objected, he would get smeared. What Kennedy, Soto, and Tapscott could not know was what Bosch knew in the deepest, darkest part of his heart, that he had not planted evidence against Borders, that he had never planted evidence against any suspect or adversary in his life. And this knowledge gave Bosch an affirming jolt of adrenaline and purpose. He knew that there were two kinds of truth in this world. The truth that was the unalterable bedrock of one's life and mission, and the other malleable truth of politicians, charlatans, corrupt lawyers, and their clients bent and molded to serve whatever purpose was at hand. Borders, either with or without his attorney's knowledge, had lied to Soto and Tapscott at San Quentin. In doing so, he had corrupted their investigation from the start. It confirmed for Bosch that this was a scam, and that it was up to him to root out those who plotted against him, wherever they were. He was coming for them now. The weight and guilt of possibly having made a horrible mistake so long ago was lifted. It was Bosch who felt like the man proven innocent and released from a cage. Chapter 14. The killers of Jose Esquivel and his son had acted in the pharmacy video with the assurance of men who had done this kind of work before. They had used revolvers, both to prevent their weapons jamming and to avoid leaving behind critical evidence. They showed no hesitation, no remorse. Bosch knew that in every large criminal enterprise, there was a need for such men, enforcers willing to do what had to be done to ensure the survival and success of the organization. In reality, such men were rare. This was what led to his suspicion that the killers were brought in from far outside San Fernando to deal with the problem created by the idealistic but naive Jose Esquivel Jr. That suspicion seemed to be confirmed when Bosch, Lourdes, and Sisto returned to Whiteman Airport early that evening with a warrant to view surveillance footage from the airstrip's cameras. Beginning their review of video at noon Sunday, they fast-forwarded through the hours, slowing to real-time speed only when the occasional plane landed or took off, or when a vehicle approached the row of hangars that ran along the edge of the airfield. They were in the airport's cramped utility room beneath the tower. It also served as a security office. The space was so tight that Bosch could smell Sisto's nicotine gum. At 9:10 a.m. on the video, their vigil paid off when the same van they had seen pick up the lineup of pill shills at the clinic drove up to the hangar, opened its two doors wide by remote control, and then waited, its driver getting out and going inside only briefly before returning. 14 minutes later, the jump plane landed and taxied to and then into the hangar. Only two men disembarked, white men in dark clothing that appeared very similar to that worn by the Farmacia shooters. They walked directly to the van and climbed in through the side door. The van drove off before the plane's propeller had even stopped turning. "It's them," Sisto said. "Fuckers now go to the mall and kill our victims." He said it with the tone of anger Bosch liked, but he knew that emotional belief and evidence were two different things. "How do you know?" he asked. "Oh, come on," Sisto said. "It's gotta be. The timing is perfect. They fly in, do the job, and you watch. They're going to fly them out again after it's over." Bosch nodded. "I'm there with you. But what we know and what we can prove are two different things," he said. The men in the pharmacy were masked. He pointed to the video monitor. "Can we prove that's them?" he asked. "We can ask the sheriff's lab to try to clean this up," Lourdes said. "Make it clear?" "Maybe," Bosch said. "Speed it up." Sisto was handling the remote. He boosted the playback to 4x speed, and they waited. Bosch watched the minutes go by on the video timer. At the 10:15 a.m. mark, he told Sisto to drop it back to real-time playback. The pharmacy video that had captured the murders placed the time of the killings at 10:14 a.m., and the drugstore was approximately 2 miles from Whiteman. At 10:21, the van returned to the airport. It traveled within the speed limit, no hurry as it went through the gate and approached the hangar. Once it was there, the side door slid open, and the two men exited and walked directly to the jump plane. Its prop was already turning, and it taxied back out to the runway for takeoff. "In and out, just like that, and two people are dead," Lourdes said. "Gotta get these guys," Sisto said. "We will," Bosch said. "But I want the guy who made the call. The man who put those two hitters on the plane." "Santos," Lourdes said. Bosch nodded. It was a moment of true resolve for the three detectives. Sisto finally broke the silence. "So what's our next move, Harry?" he asked. "The van," Bosch said. "Tomorrow we bring in the driver and see what he has to say." "We work our way up the ladder," Sisto said. "I like it." "Easier said than done," Bosch said. "We have to assume that anybody working for Santos is working for him because he's a trusted soldier. He won't be afraid of prison time, and that will make him hard to crack." "Then what do we do?" "We put the fear of God in him. We make him afraid of Santos if he's not afraid of us." Before leaving the airport, Bosch sent Lourdes up the tower to talk to O'Connor and used the second warrant to collect the clipboard log that documented the comings and goings of the jump plane, in particular the landing on Monday morning before the pharmacy shooting. It would be marked as evidence with the video itself. The detectives then called it a day, agreeing to meet in the war room at 8 the following morning to plan the takedown of the van driver. From there, Sisto and Lourdes headed to Magalie's for a late dinner, while Bosch decided to head home. He wanted to put in some time on the border's case file before sleep deprivation caught up and knocked him down. There was a time when Bosch could easily go 2 days on a case without sleep, but that time was long gone. It was late enough for the freeway to be clear, and he moved easily into the slipstream of traffic. He called his daughter, whom he had not talked to in several days except through customary goodnight texts. She surprised him by answering. Usually at night, she was too busy to talk. "Hey, Dad. How are you, Mads?" "Stressed. I've got midterms this week. I'm about to go to the library." This was a sore subject with Bosch. His daughter liked to study at the school library because the place helped her focus. But she often stayed until midnight or later, and that left her walking by herself to her car, parked in an underground garage. They had discussed this repeatedly, but she had dug in on it and was unwilling to accept the 10 p.m. curfew Bosch had tried to impose. When he didn't respond, his daughter did. "Please don't add to my stress by lecturing me in the library. It's perfectly safe, and I'll be there with lots of kids." "I'm not worried about the library. I'm worried about the garage."
"Dad, we've been over this. It's a safe campus. I'll be fine."
There was a saying in police work that places were safe until they weren't. It only took one moment, one bad actor, one chance crossing of predator and prey to change things. But he had already shared all of this with her and didn't want to turn the call into an argument. "If you have midterms, does that mean you'll be coming up to L.A. after?"
"No, sorry, Dad. Me and the roomies are going down to IB as soon as we're all free. I'll come up next time I can."
Bosch knew that one of her three roommates was from Imperial Beach down by the border. "Just don't go across, okay?"
"Dad."
She drew the word out like it was a life sentence.
"Okay, okay.
What about spring break? I thought we were going to Hawaii or something."
"This is spring break. I'm going to IB for 4 days and then back up here. Because spring break isn't really a break. I have two psych projects to work on."
Bosch felt bad. He had fumbled the Hawaii idea, having mentioned it a few months earlier, and then not followed through. Now she had plans. He knew his time with her, and being part of her life, was fleeting, and this was a reminder.
"Well, look, save one night for me, would you? You name the night, and I'll come down, and we can eat somewhere on the circle. I just want to see you."
"Okay, I will. But actually, there's a Moza down here in Newport. Can we go there?" It was her favorite pizza place in L.A.
"Wherever you want."
"Great, Dad. But I gotta go."
"Okay, love you. Be safe."
"You too."
Then she was gone.
Bosch felt a wave of grief. His daughter's world was expanding. She was going places, and it was the natural way of things. He loved seeing it and hated living it. She had only been a daily part of his life for a few years before it was time for her to go.
Bosch regretted all the lost years before. When he got to his house, there was a car parked out front, with a figure slumped in the front seat. It was 9 p.m., and Bosch was not expecting company. He parked in the carport and walked out to the street, coming up behind the car blocking the front walkway to his house. As he approached, he turned on the light on his phone and shined it through the driver's open window. Jerry Edgar was asleep behind the wheel. Bosch tapped lightly on his shoulder until Edgar startled and looked up at him. Because there was a streetlight above and behind him, Bosch was in silhouette.
Harry?
Hey, partner.
Shit, I fell asleep. What time is it?
About 9.
Shit, man, I was out.
What's up?
I came by to talk to you.
I checked the mail on the box and saw you're still in the same house. Then let's go in. Bosch opened the car door for him. They went in the front door after Bosch gathered the mail Edgar had checked.
Honey, I'm home, Bosch called out.
Edgar gave him an are-you-kidding-me look. He'd always known Bosch to be a loner. Bosch smiled and shook his head.
Just kidding, he said. You want a drink? I'm out of beer. I got a bottle of bourbon, and that's about it.
Bourbon's good, Edgar said. Maybe with a cube or two? Bosch signaled him into the living room while he cut right into the kitchen. He got two glasses out of a cabinet and dropped some ice into them. He heard Edgar pull the broomstick out of the sliding door track and open the slider. Bosch grabbed the bottle of bourbon off the top of the refrigerator and went out to the deck. Edgar was standing at the railing, looking down into the Cahuenga Pass.
Place still looks the same, Edgar said.
You mean the house or the canyon? Bosch asked.
I guess both.
Cheers. Bosch handed him both glasses so he could crack the seal on the bottle and pour.
Wait a minute, Edgar said when he saw the label.
Are you kidding me?
About what? Bosch asked.
Harry, do you know what that stuff is?
This?
Bosch looked at the label. Edgar turned and dumped the ice over the railing. He then held the empty glasses out to Bosch.
You don't put ice in Pappy Van Winkle?
You don't?
That'd be like putting ketchup on a hot dog.
Bosch shook his head. He didn't get the comparison Edgar was making.
People put ketchup on hot dogs all the time, he said.
Edgar held out the glasses and Bosch started pouring.
Easy now, Edgar said. Where'd you get this?
It was a gift from somebody I did some work for, Bosch said. He must be doing pretty good. You look this stuff up on eBay, and you'll wish you never cracked the seal. You could have bought your daughter a car.
It's a she, the one I did the work for.
Bosch looked at the label on the bottle again. He held the opening to his nose and picked up a deep, smoky tang.
A car, huh? He said.
Well, at least a down payment, Edgar said.
I almost regifted this and gave it to the chief up at San Fernando. I guess it would have made his Christmas.
More like his whole year. Bosch put the bottle down on the 2x4 railing cap, and Edgar immediately panicked. He grabbed the bottle before an earthquake or a Santa Ana wind could send it down into the dark arroyo below. He put it safely down on a table next to the lounge chair. He came back and they leaned side by side on the rail and sipped and looked into the pass. At the bottom, the 101 freeway was still a ribbon of white light coming up through Hollywood and one of red light going south. Bosch waited for Edgar to get down to the reason for his visit, but nothing came. His old partner seemed content to sip rare bourbon and view the lights.
So, what made you drive up here tonight? Bosch finally asked.
Oh, I don't know, Edgar said.
Something about seeing you today. Seeing that you're still in the game made me think. I hate my job, Harry. We'd never get anything done. Sometimes I think the state wants to protect bad doctors, not get rid of them.
Well, you're still pulling down a paycheck.
I'm not, unless you count the hundo they give me a month for equipment costs.
Edgar laughed.
That much, huh?
You're rolling in the green. He held out his glass. And Bosch clicked his off of it.
Oh, yeah, he said. Making bank.
How about fucking Hollywood, Edgar said. Don't even have a homicide table anymore.
Yeah, things change.
They clicked glasses again, and sipped for a few quiet moments before Edgar finally got down to what he'd come up the hill to say. "So Charlie Hoven called me up today. Wanted to know all about you." "What did you say?" Edgar turned and looked directly at Bosch. It was so dark on the deck that Bosch could only see a glint of reflection in his eyes. "I said you were good people. I said trust you and treat you right." "I appreciate that, J. Edgar." "Harry, whatever it is, I want in. I've been sitting on the sidelines too long, watching this shit go down. I'm asking you to include me." Bosch took a draw of smoky bourbon before responding. "We could use all the help we can get. Today I thought you just wanted to get us out of the office." "Yeah, because you were a reminder of what I should be fucking doing." Bosch nodded. When he and Edgar were partners in Hollywood 25 years before, he had never had the sense that Edgar was all in. But he knew the need for redemption comes in all kinds of ways at all kinds of times. "You know where San Fernando even is?" Bosch asked. "Sure," Edgar said. "Went up to the courthouse in San Fernando a few times on cases." "Well, if you want in, be at San Fernando PD at 8 tomorrow. We've got a strategy meeting. We're going to take down a capper and start fishing. We'll probably bring Dr. Herrera in at some point, too. We could probably use your help with that." "Do you have to clear it first?" "I think the chief will take all the help he can get on this. I'll talk to him." "I'll be there, Harry." He took down the last of his bourbon in one gulp, savored it, and then swallowed. He put the empty glass on the railing and pointed at the glass as he backed away. "Smooth. Thanks for that, Harry." "Want another hit?" "Would love it. But early start tomorrow, I should go home." "You got somebody there waiting, Jerry?" "Matter of fact, I do. I got remarried when I was working in Vegas. Nice girl." "I got married in Vegas once." It was the first time Bosch had thought about Eleanor Wish in a long time. Edgar gave him a sad smile. "Tomorrow," he said. He clapped Bosch on the upper arm and headed back into the house and toward the front door. Bosch remained on the deck, sipping his expensive bourbon and thinking about the past. He heard Edgar's car start up and pull away into the night. Chapter 15. In the morning, Bosch ate breakfast at the corner at the Horseless Carriage, a diner located in the center of the vast Ford dealership in Van Nuys. It would only be a few miles from there to San Fernando, and he had grown tired of eating the free breakfast burritos dropped off in the war room each morning. The Horseless had a 50s feel to it, and was a lasting reminder of the population and expansion boom that swept the valley after World War II. The car became king, and Van Nuys was an auto-buying mecca, with dealerships lined up side by side, and offering coffee shops and restaurants as draws to their customers. Bosch ordered the French toast and watched the video he had been texted the night before on the burner phone he had bought to communicate with Lucia Soto. The video had come from a strange number, which he assumed belonged to a burner Soto was now using herself. The video was Tapscott's recording of the opening of the evidence box in the Danielle Schuyler case. Bosch had watched it repeatedly the night before until he was too tired to keep his eyes open, but no matter how many times he viewed it, he could not figure out how the evidence box had been tampered with. The old and yellowed evidence labels were clearly intact as the box was presented to the camera and then cut open by Soto. This continually agitated Bosch, because he knew there was a kink in the line somewhere between property control and the lab table, where Lucas John Ulmer's DNA was found on Schuyler's clothing. If he started with the bedrock knowledge that Ulmer's DNA had been planted, then he had to figure out two things. One was how DNA from a man who had died 2 years earlier had been procured in the first place, and the other was how it had been planted on the clothing contained in a sealed evidence box. The first question had been answered, to Bosch's satisfaction at least, the night before, After Edgar left, and he finally got the chance to review the Border's investigative file for a second time. This time he paid careful attention to the file within the file. The records from Ulmer's prosecution and conviction on multiple rape charges in 1998. In his first swing through the records, Boschett paid closer attention to the investigative side of the case, exhibiting a detective's bias that a case was put together during the investigation and that the prosecution was only the strategic revelation of the accumulated facts and evidence to the jury. Therefore, he believed anything in the prosecution files would already have been covered in the investigative files. Bosch learned about how wrong he had been about this mindset when he read through a sheaf of motions and countermotions filed by both the prosecution and defense. Most were boilerplate legal arguments, motions to suppress evidence or testimony made by the prosecution or defense. Then Bosch came across a defense motion stating that it was Ulmer's intention at trial to challenge the DNA evidence in the case. The motion asked the judge to order the state to provide the defense with a portion of the genetic evidence collected during the investigation so that independent analysis could take place. The motion was not challenged by the state, and Judge Richard Pittman ordered the district attorney's office to split the genetic material with the defense. The defense motion had been written by Ulmer's attorney, Lance Cronin. It was a routine pretrial move, but what drew Bosch's attention was the witness list submitted by the defense at the start of the trial. There were only 5 witnesses on the list, and after each name, there was a summary of who the person was and what they would testify to. None of the 5 were chemists or forensic specialists. This told Bosch that during the trial, Cronin did not put forth alternate DNA findings, as the motion filed earlier had suggested. He had gone in another direction, which could have been anything from claiming the sex was consensual to hammering at the state's own DNA collection protocol and analysis. Whatever it was, it didn't work. Ulmer went down on all charges and was shipped off to prison, and there was no record in the file of what happened to the genetic material signed over to his lawyer by the judge. Bosch knew that the DA's office should have requested the return of the material after the trial, but there was nothing in the records to indicate this had been done. Ulmer was convicted and sent away on a sentence he couldn't possibly outlive. The reality, Bosch knew, was that institutional entropy probably took over. Prosecutors and investigators moved on to other cases and trials. The missing DNA was unaccounted for, and therefore it could have been the source of the genetic material found on Daniel Schuyler's pajamas. Proving it, though, was another matter, especially when Bosch could not figure out how that microdot of DNA got there. Still, for the moment, he had what was certainly a crack in the facade of a seemingly solid case for wrongful conviction. There was DNA unaccounted for, and the defense lawyer, who moved between the 2 cases in question, may have had access to it. He pushed his plate away and checked his watch. It was 7:40, and time to get to the war room. He stood up, left a 20 on the counter, and headed out to his car. He stayed on surface streets, taking Roscoe over to Laurel Canyon, and then heading up. Along the way, he took a call from Mickey Holler.
"Funny. I was going to call you," Bosch said.
"Oh yeah," Holler said. "About what?"
"I decided I definitely want to engage your services. I want to come in as a third party at the hearing next week and oppose the release of Preston Borders. Whatever that takes in legal terms."
"All right, we can do that. You want any media on it? This is going to be an unusual hearing with a retired detective going up against the DA. It's a good story."
"Not yet. It's going to get ugly when it comes up that Borders claims I planted evidence and the DA apparently agrees."
"What the fuck?"
"Yeah, I've been through the whole file. Borders claims that I planted the key evidence, the seahorse pennant, in his apartment. Accusing me is the only way to sell this."
"Did he offer any proof of this?"
"No, but he doesn't have to. If the DNA points to a convicted rapist, then the only plausible evidence of Borders being in possession of the pendant is that it was planted."
"Okay, understood.
You're right. This is going to get down and dirty. And I see why you want to keep the media out of it if possible. But now the big question.
What do you got that knocks down this house of cards?
I'm only halfway there. I know where and how they could have gotten Ulmer's DNA. I just need to find out how they were then able to salt the evidence with it.
Sounds like you've done the easy part, if you ask me.
I'm working on the hard part.
Is that why you called? To encourage me?
No, actually, I've got a little gift for you.
What's that?
Bosch was now off of Laurel Canyon and cruising up Brand Boulevard and passing the Welcome to San Fernando sign.
Well, when you first told me about this, the name Preston Borders rang a bell. I remembered it, but I couldn't place it. I was in law school at Southwestern, and of course I didn't know about you at the time. Anyway, I used to go to the criminal courts building between classes and sit in courtrooms, watch defense lawyers work.
Never interested in how prosecutors worked?
Not really. Not with my father, our father, having been a defense attorney. The point is, I'm pretty sure I watched some of the Borders trial, and that would have put you and me in the same room without knowing each other 30 years ago.
I thought that was sort of neat.
Yeah, neat.
That's why you called? That's the gift?
No. The gift is this. Our father died young. In fact, I never saw him in a courtroom. But he had a young partner who carried on. And that's the guy I used to go watch at the CCB.
You're talking about David Siegel?
He was the partner?
That's right.
And he defended Preston Borders in that trial in 1988. I grew up calling him Uncle David. He was a great lawyer, and they called him Legal Siegel around the courthouse. He's the one that sent me to law school.
What happened to his practice?
Do you think there are any records still around from the trial? They might be useful.
You see, that's my gift to you, my brother.
You don't need records. You've got Legal Siegel.
What are you talking about? He's dead. There's an obit in the file. I read it last night.
Bosch had to wait at the crossing, a block from the station, for a metro train to go screaming through.
Holler heard it over the phone and waited for silence before responding.
Let me tell you a story, he said. When he retired from the practice of law, Legal Siegel did not want to be found by any of the, let's say, unsavory clients he represented over the years, especially those who might not have been pleased with the outcome of their interaction.
He didn't want guys getting out of prison and looking him up, Bosch said.
Geez, I wonder why.
I've had the experience myself, and it's not pleasant. So, Legal Siegel sold his practice and pulled a disappearing act. He even had one of his sons send an obituary of his own creation to the newsletter of the California Bar. I remember reading it. It called him a legal genius.
That's what I read. Soto and Tapscott put it in the file because they said Siegel was dead. You're telling me he's still alive?
He's going on 86 years old, and I try to visit him every few weeks or so.
Bosch pulled into a parking space in the SFPD side lot. He checked the dash clock and saw he was late. The personal cars of all the other detectives were already there.
I need to talk to him, he said.
In the new files, Borders throws him under the bus. He's not going to like that.
I'm sure he won't, Holler said.
But that's a good break for you. If you impugn the reputation of a lawyer, he's allowed to fight back.
I'll set up an interview and we'll record it.
What's your availability going to be?
The sooner the better. You said he was pushing 86. Is he all there?
Absolutely. Sharp as a stiletto mentally. Physically, not so much. He's bedridden. They move him around in a wheelchair, bring him a sandwich from Langer's or Philippe's, and he'll go on a nostalgic bender about old cases. That's what I do. I love to hear him talk cases.
All right. Set it up. Let me know.
I'm on it.
Bosch killed the engine and opened the Jeep's door. He quickly tried to remember if there was anything he needed to ask Holler.
Oh, one other thing, he said. You remember at Christmas when we got those bottles of bourbon from Viviana at the Fruit Box Foundation?
Viviana Veracruz was an artist both Holler and Bosch had encountered on a private case they had worked the year before.
Happy Pappy, yes I do, Holler said.
I remember you offered me $100 for mine, Bosch said.
I almost took it.
Offer still stands, unless you finish that sucker off.
No, I didn't even crack it open until last night, and that's when I found out I could have gotten about 20 times what you offered.
Really?
Yeah, really.
You're a scoundrel, Holler. Just wanted you to know I'm on to you.
Bosch could hear Holler chuckling at the other end of the line.
Laugh it up, Bosch said. But I'm keeping it.
Hey, there are no morals and no ethics when it comes to choice Kentucky bourbon, Holler said. Especially Pappy Van Winkle.
I'm gonna remember that.
You do that. Talk to you later. The call ended and Bosch went to the side door of the station. He walked through the empty detective bureau and opened the door to the war room. He was immediately hit with the fresh smell of breakfast burritos. It was a full house. Sitting around the table and eating were Lourdes, Sisto, Luzon, Captain Trevino, and Chief Valdez. Jerry Edgar was also in attendance with a man Bosch had never seen before. He was late 30s with dark hair and a deep tan. He wore a golf shirt with sleeves tight on his expanded biceps.
Sorry I'm late, Bosch said. I didn't know it was going to be all hands on deck.
We were eating while waiting, Lourdes said. Harry, this is Agent Hovan from the DEA.
Chapter 16. The man with the tight sleeves stood up and reached across the table to shake Bosch's hand. As he did so, he assessed Bosch the way an art critic might look for the first time at a sculpture, or a college football coach at a high school cornerback. After freeing his hand from Hovan's grip, Bosch pulled out a chair at the end of the table and sat down. Lourdes picked up the tray of breakfast burritos and offered to pass it down, but Bosch put his hand up and shook his head.
So, he said, Agent Hovan, what brings you here first thing this morning?
You called. I wanted to respond, Hovan said. Since it was Jerry who referred me to you, I spoke with him yesterday about you and the case and thought it would be best if we all met in person.
To brief us all on Santos, Bosch asked.
Before Hovan answered, the chief spoke up. Agent Hovan came in to see me first thing this morning, he said. He's going to brief us all, but he also has a couple of ideas about our investigation.
Our investigation, Bosch said.
Harry, don't get ruffled, Valdez said. It's not what you think. Just hear the man out.
I think Harry's right, Sisto said. When the feds come in, they come in to take things over. This is our case.
Could we just give him a chance to talk? The chief insisted.
Bosch made a gesture, giving Hovan the go-ahead, but he admired Sisto for standing up.
Okay. I think I got the lay of the land from your chief and Jerry, Hovan said. You've got the two-bagger, and you've zeroed in on the clinic over in Pacoima. Today, you were probably going to come in here, put your heads together, and decide to go small to get big. Am I right?
What does that mean? Lourdes asked.
You were going to pick off a pill shill or a capper and start trading up, right? Hovan said.
It's how it usually works.
And that's a problem? Lourdes asked.
It's usually the way it works, because it's what works.
She glanced at Bosch to back her up.
Yes, that was the plan, Bosch said. But I suppose the DEA has an alternate suggestion.
Correct, Hovan said.
If you want to get the man who ordered the hit on that pharmacy, then you're talking about Santos. And there ain't nobody in the world who knows Santos and his operation like I do. And I can tell you, catching small fish to go after the big fish is not going to work.
Why is that? Lourdes asked.
Because the big fish is too insulated, Hovan said. Based on what I've been told about this case, I would say you have it right. Those two hitters were sent by Santos, but you'll never make that connection. For all we know, those two are already dead and buried in the desert. Santos doesn't take chances.
So then how do we get him? Lourdes asked.
The tone of her voice revealed her dislike of the idea of the big shot Fed dropping in to school them on their own case.
You need somebody inside, Hovan said.
That's your idea? Lourdes asked.
That's it, he said. You have an opportunity here. A way in.
Me, Sisto said. I'll go undercover.
Everyone turned to look at Sisto. His eagerness to assume a key role in the case was outweighing his inexperience and the danger of undercover work.
No, not you, Hovan said.
He pointed across the table at Bosch.
Him, he said.
What are you talking about? Lourdes asked.
How old are you, Detective Bosch? Hovan asked.
Over 65, I'm guessing.
Yes, Bosch said.
Hovan gestured, as if presenting Bosch to the others at the table. We take Detective Bosch.
Make him look a little older, a little more worn, and a little more hungry. We give him a new ID and Medicare card. We change his clothes, take away his razor and soap for a few days. What we do is follow the clinic's van and arrest a few of the shills at a pharmacy, make it look like a random enforcement operation. Jerry and I take care of that. Then, when the capper gets back to the clinic and is a few bodies short and looking at being a few thousand pills short by the end of the month, in walks the perfect recruit. Hovan used his hands again to offer Bosch to the group.
The perfect recruit? Luzon said.
He's the right age, and just what they'll be looking for, Hovan said. You ever work undercover, detective? All eyes went to Bosch.
Not really, he said. A few times here and there, on cases, nothing serious.
Just how close would I be able to get to Santos if I'm being run around the state to pharmacies all day?
Put it this way, closer than anybody else in law enforcement, Hovan said.
Santos is a phantom. He's the Howard Hughes of hillbilly heroin. Nobody's seen him in nearly a year. Our intel photos of him are even older. But here's the thing.
Hovan opened a thin manila file that had been on the table in front of him. It contained a 2-page document stapled together. He held it up for all to see.
This is a John Doe arrest warrant for Santos. It's a RICO case, and it's solid. And this warrant was issued more than a year ago. We have not executed it because we can't identify or find the guy. But you might be able to. You get recruited, and you might get close enough to signal us in. We'll set you up with all you need. You see Santos, you call us in, and we take him down. You take down the man who ordered the hit on that pharmacy, maybe we even get the shooters.
Hovan had spun the plan with an urgent tone in his voice. It was met with a long silence as it was considered. Bosch held his hand out for the file containing the warrant, and Hovan passed it over. Harry took a quick glance at it to make sure it hadn't been a prop. It looked legit. John Doe, a.k.a. Santos, charged under the Federal Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. It was the catch-all law used by the feds to go after mobsters for almost 50 years. It was Lourdes who broke the silence.
We heard your last inside man took a plane ride and never came back, she said.
Yeah, but he wasn't a cop, Hovan said. He was an amateur and made an amateur mistake. That wouldn't happen with Bosch. He'd be prepped and pretty. That's what we call being totally ready to go under. I mean, this is a perfect opportunity here.
Hovan looked directly at Bosch to make his final pitch.
I gotta admit, when I checked you out with Jerry and heard you were an old guy, my mind started working overtime. We don't get guys your age doing UC work. I mean, none. You're the perfect way in.
Bosch was beginning to bristle.
Yeah, enough with the old guy stuff, he said. I get your point.
Chief Valdez cleared his throat and stepped into the conversation before anybody else could respond.
If Harry gets on a plane, he could end up anywhere, he said.
I don't like that.
Most likely he'd be taken down to Slab City, Hovan said.
And what exactly is Slab City?
A retired military base down near the bottom of the Salton Sea. When they closed the base, they pulled everything out of there except the hard surfaces. That's the landing strips and the slabs they built the Quonsets on. The squatters came in and took over, built their own places. Then the Santos operation came in, used the airstrips, and built a tent city for his operation.
Why don't you just go in and shut it all down, Lourdes asked.
Because we want Santos, Hovan said. We don't care about the addicts he runs his shills. They're a dime a dozen. We want the head of the snake. And that's why we need somebody inside to send out the signal when he's there.
Okay, we need to think about this, Valdez said. Detective Bosch also needs to decide if this is something he would even be willing to do. He is a reserve officer in the department, and I'm not going to order him to do anything with a risk factor like you're talking about here. So give us a day or two and we'll get back to you with an answer.
Hovan raised his palms in a hands-off manner.
Hey, roger that, Hovan said. I just wanted to come up here and make my pitch.
I'll let you people get back to work. You call me with your decision.
He stood up to leave, but Bosch stopped him with three words.
I'll do it, he said.
Hovan looked at him, and a smile started to spread on his face.
Harry, wait a minute, Valdez said. I think we should take our time and consider other options.
Harry, are you sure? Lourdes added.
This is dangerous.
Give me a couple days to get ready, Bosch said. I'll give it a shot.
Okay, Hovan said. Don't shave and don't bathe. Body odor is a tell. If you don't stink, you ain't a user.
Good to know, Bosch said.
I can hook you up with a user if you want to research it, the agent offered.
Nah, Bosch said. I think I know somebody I can talk to.
When do we do this?
Bosch looked at the faces surrounding the table. The looks of concern far outweighed the look of excitement on Hovan's face.
How about we go Friday, Hovan said. That'll give us time to work out logistics and request a shadow team. Maybe get you some time with our UC trainers.
I want full coverage on him, Valdez said. I don't have the people to do it, but I don't want Harry out there with his ass in the breeze.
He won't be, Hovan said. We'll have him covered.
What about when he's on that plane, Lourdes asked.
We'll have air support, Hovan said. We won't lose him. We'll be so high above that plane they won't even know we're there.
And when he lands, Edgar asked.
I'm not going to candy coat it. When he gets to Slab City, he's on his own. But we'll be nearby and ready for the signal.
That ended the questions from Lourdes.
Hovan looked at the chief.
You have a photo of Bosch we can use to make a dummy DL?
Valdez nodded.
We have the shot we made his police ID with, he said.
Captain Trevino can take you into the op center to get that.
Trevino got up to lead Hovan out. The DEA agent said he would be in touch and would come back Friday morning, ready to go with the undercover operation.
After he was gone, all eyes returned to Bosch.
What? He said.
I still want you to think about this, Valdez said.
Any second thoughts, and we pull out.
Bosch thought about Jose Jr. and his naive bravery.
No, he said. Let's do it.
Why, Harry? Lourdes asked.
You've done your part for years and years. Why are you doing this?
Bosch shrugged. He didn't like all the attention on him.
I think about that kid going to college to learn how to do what his father did, he said.
Then he graduates and gets into the business and finds the corruption of it. He goes through all of that, and, big surprise, he does the right thing, and it gets him killed. People can call him stupid or naive. I call him a hero, and that's why I'm all in. I want Santos more than Agent Hovan does. He had their rapt attention now.
What they did to Jose Esquivel shouldn't just go by, Bosch added.
If this is the best shot we have at Santos, then I want to take it.
Valdez nodded.
Okay, Harry, we get it, he said.
And we're with you 100%.
Bosch nodded his thanks and looked across the table at his old partner, Edgar. He nodded too. He was on board.
Chapter 17. Holler set up the Legal Siegel interview for that afternoon. The former defense attorney, presumed dead by many, including Lance Cronin and his client, Preston Borders, was living in a nursing home in the Fairfax area. Bosch met Holler in the parking lot at 2 p.m. It was one of the rare occasions Bosch saw Holler emerge from the front seat of his Lincoln, and the lawyer explained that he was between drivers at the moment. They proceeded inside. Holler held a briefcase that he told Bosch he was using to carry a video camera and to smuggle in a French dip sandwich from Kohl's in downtown.
This is a kosher joint, Holler explained. No food allowed in from the outside.
What happens if they catch you, Bosch asked.
I don't know. Maybe I get banned for life.
So he's cool with doing the interview?
Said he was. Once he eats, he'll want to talk.
In the lobby, they signed in as David Siegel's lawyer and investigator. They then took an elevator up to the third floor. Signing in as Holler's investigator reminded Bosch of something.
How's Sisko doing? He asked.
Dennis Sisko Wojciechowski was Holler's longtime investigator. 2 years earlier, he and his Harley were taken down on Ventura Boulevard in an intentional hit and run. He went through three surgeries on his left knee and came out with a Vicodin addiction that took him 6 months to recognize before he treated it cold turkey.
He's good, Holler said. Real good. He's back and busy.
I need to talk to him.
Not a problem.
Can I tell him what it's about?
Got a friend I think is addicted to hillbilly heroin. I want to ask him what to look for and what to do.
Then he's your man.
I'll call him for you as soon as we get out of here.
They exited the elevator on the third floor, and Holler informed the woman posted at the nursing station that he was visiting his client, David Siegel, and should not be disturbed. They proceeded down the hallway to Siegel's private room. Holler pulled a doorknob hanger out of the inside pocket of his suit coat. It said, "Legal conference. Do not disturb." He winked at Bosch as he hung it on the knob and closed the door. The wall-mounted TV was blaring a CNN report on a congressional investigation into Russia's meddling with the presidential election the year before. An old man propped up on a hospital bed was watching it. He looked like he didn't weigh more than 100 pounds, and he had wispy white hair that surrounded his head on the pillow like a halo. He wore an old golf shirt with a Wilshire Country Club crest. His arms were skinny, the skin wrinkled, and mottled with age spots. His hands looked lifeless and were folded on top of the blanket that was tucked up neatly under his arms and over his chest. Holler moved around the bed and waved to get the bedridden man's attention.
"Uncle David," Holler said loudly.
"Hi. I'm going to turn this down."
Holler took the TV remote off a side table and killed the sound from the TV.
"Damn Russians," Siegel muttered. "I hope I live long enough to see that guy impeached."
"Spoken like a true lefty," Holler said. "But I doubt that's gonna happen."
He turned back to the man in the bed.
"So how are you?" Holler said.
"This is Harry Bosch, my half-brother. I've told you about him."
Siegel put his watery eyes on Bosch and studied him.
"You're the one," he said. "Mickey told me about you. He said you came to the house one time."
Bosch knew he was talking about Michael Holler Sr., his father. Bosch had met him only the one time, in his Beverly Hills mansion. He was sick and soon to die. Bosch was fresh back from war in Southeast Asia. When he entered the house, he saw a boy of about 5 or 6 standing with the housekeeper. He knew then that he had a half-brother. A month later, he stood on a hillside and watched as their father was put into the ground.
"Yes," Bosch said. "That was a long time ago." "Well," Siegel said, "for me, everything was a long time ago. The longer you live, the more you can't believe how things have changed."
He gestured weakly toward the silent TV screen. "I brought you something that hasn't changed in 100 years, Holler said. "Dropped by Kohl's on my way over and got you a French dip."
"Kohl's is good," Siegel said. "I didn't eat at lunch because I knew you were coming. Raise me up."
Holler grabbed another remote off the table and tossed it to Bosch. While Holler opened his briefcase to get out the sandwich, Bosch raised the upper portion of the bed until Siegel was in an almost seated position.
"We've met before," Bosch said.
"Sort of met.
You cross-examined me on the stand in the case we're going to talk about today." "Of course," Siegel said. "I remember. You were very thorough. A good witness for the prosecution."
Bosch nodded his thanks as Holler tucked the napkin into the open collar of the old man's shirt. He then slid the overbed table across his lap and unwrapped the sandwich in front of him. He opened up a styrofoam sidecar of Jew and put it down on the table as well. Siegel immediately picked up one half of the sandwich, dipped the edge into the juice, and started eating it, taking small bites and savoring each one of them. While Siegel ate his sandwich and thought about the old days, Holler took the mini camcorder out of his briefcase and set it up on a mini tripod on the overbed table. He adjusted the table while looking at the framing of the shot, and then they were ready. It took Legal Siegel 35 minutes to eat his French dip sandwich. Bosch waited patiently while Holler asked the old man questions about days gone by, getting him ready for the interview. Finally, Siegel balled up the sandwich wrap and was done. He tossed it toward a trash can in the corner and came well short. Holler picked up the debris and put it back in his briefcase. "You ready, Uncle Dave?" he asked.
"Been ready," Siegel said.
Holler pulled the napkin out of the collar of Siegel's shirt and adjusted the camera once more before holding his finger on the record button. "All right, here we go," he said.